I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Ever since the publication of her book, Against Interpretation, in 1966, our guest, Susan Sontag, has been a reigning American intellectual, maybe the reigning intellectual. Her appetite for knowledge is voracious. Her range of interest is staggering. Her passion for ideas is limitless. She's written about cinema, politics, human rights, culture, philosophy, ballet, opera, theater, art, photography, notably, illness, and always literature. Not only is she intemperately in love with reading, there are 15,000 books in her library, she seems to remember everything she's read. At 10 years old, she discovered the modern library. At 15, she went to college. At 17, she married a professor who was 10 years her senior. At 19, she had her only child. The early years of her marriage were so saturated with intellectual discussions, her two-year-old son would chant, "Hegel, Hegel, Hegel." And then one day she walked into a movie house and saw a Rock Around the Clock and thought for the first time that she might be missing something in her life. She left her marriage, moved to New York, began to write about everything. Susan Sontag has just written a new novel called In America. Like her last novel, The Volcano Lover, In America is an historical novel. Connection listeners, we're talking with Susan Sontag this hour, among other things, about the hunger that so many people, so many Connection listeners seem to have for knowledge, for art, for ideas, for discovery, for surprise. Do you share that quality that she praises the most? The word is avidity. How's to slake this thirst for conversation and books and people? The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. We're hanging out with Susan Sontag this hour. Welcome back.
Hi, Chris.
I wanted to talk to you about just the word hunger and hungry. It was very much the sort of key word of Joan Acocella's wonderful piece about you in The New Yorker a few weeks ago. But it seemed to be a condition, hunger, among us well-fed people that I don't think we talk about enough.
Well, it's the appetite for pleasure. It's the appetite for change. I mean, you have only one life, and there's so many things to see and think about and worry about and enjoy. It seems to me quite natural. I don't know. I never. I mean, this is something. I have to tell you, I cringe a little bit when I'm introduced in the way you just have, Chris. And I know it's very well meant, but it's sort of like, to me, it's like having feet or something. I mean, if you have feet, you walk, or, you know, or maybe I run sometimes as well as walk, but if anything, it's almost, it sounds pretty good. I don't mean to say you're flattering me, but I mean to say that I don't think of it as an accomplishment, really. If anything, I think it's more like an indulgence. I mean, being interested in all these things and you know, and going to the opera and the ballet and looking at painting and reading so much and so on. I mean, the truth is that I get a lot less writing done because of all these appetites. So I actually feel it's kind of gluttony, and every once in a while I think I really ought to go on some kind of mental diet and just write.
Well, truth is, I didn't really mean to flatter you. I really meant, I think, to identify with you. I don't think I knew until we started doing this program. And people ask me how I'm interested in so many things. I don't think I realized that all kinds of people are interested in all kinds of things. It is a natural state, and it's something we ought to indulge more, if anything, to realize that not only time is short, but there's so much to not just to graze on, to learn from. Sort of, let's get busy. We were talking about, you know, how does one introduce Susan Sontag, and I think I said, well, she's the one who decided as a child she wanted to have it all and pretty much did and do it all. But maybe we all, there are thousands of Connection listeners, I think, that feel the same way. Every subject can be interesting. Because my mother used to say, only the boring are bored, let's get busy.
Oh, that's wonderful. The other way of thinking is about it is that if you are bored, just pay a little more attention to what's boring you, and you will find it's not boring at all. No, I wasn't saying you were flattering me. I was saying that the quality that and it's true. I mean, I've often been described in this way as somebody with exceptional appetites. All I wanted to say was that sometimes I actually think this is a bit of a handicap. I mean, it's one that I accept, obviously, because it's part of my temperament. But I feel, you know, another way of putting it is I'm incredibly self-indulgent. And the Puritan in me, and there is a Puritan in me, says, you know, you should stay home and work instead of going out to the opera tonight or to the ballet or reading yet another book or something, you know, that maybe I should be writing more. But obviously I don't think that all I'm here to do on this earth is write. On the contrary, I think you should only write when you feel that what you want to write is in some sense necessary. And I don't mean just necessary to you. I mean necessary, if I can put it that way, to the world. That you really have to write this, that you don't have a choice. Whereas a lot of people who write, they are... John Updike, for instance, says that he just can't imagine a day in which he doesn't write, in which he doesn't produce text. That's actually the word he used. And I can easily imagine a day in which I don't write. I'm probably most days I don't write.
What taps you in the shoulder and says, you must write this? And I asked partly because I've seen you quoted saying it's novels, it's fiction from now on.
Well, it began as fiction. My first book was a novel back in the 60s called The Benefactor. And then while I was waiting for the tank to fill up again, I wrote some essays. And those essays got a vast and, to me, very surprising amount of attention. I actually thought this was some minor activity that I would do from time to time between novels, and then the essay writing. Partly it was because they got so much attention, and that was very seductive.
Notes on Camp and all that. That's where I began.
Those essays in Against Interpretation. And the other thing was that as my appetites, the thing we started by talking about, my avidity, my hunger, my, you know, passionate enjoyment of so many things, as this intensified, the essay writing was like a way to get rid of the things. You know, it's like, I would like something a whole lot, so then I'd write about it. Then that would be a way of kind of disposing of it or not having to think about it anymore. Or it was some kind of thing, sort of sorcerer's apprentice situation where the essay writing actually got out of hand. And it seemed like a way of mastering or containing my enthusiasms. Instead, it just multiplied them. And it also multiplied or intensified my existence as a writer in the guise of someone who had a lot of opinions or ideas, which I didn't think at all was what was happening, but that's what other people thought. And then I kind of lost my nerve about writing fiction. I wrote another novel, but I wasn't entirely satisfied with that. And so I did a bunch of other things, like make movies and live in Europe and have love affairs and drift and dream and get scared about all sorts of things. And then I came back to writing fiction in the 80s and found a much freer way that has climaxed in these last two novels, and especially the new one in America.
We'll come back to the writing and the writers, or maybe we should stick with In America. This is a fiction about with a real example in it. What drove you to write it?
Well, I had started two novels in the 80s, one about an actress, actually an American actress living in the south of France and kind of fallen on hard times and a bit of a drunk and trying to get her career back. That was an idea I had for a novel, and I got about 50, 60 pages into that. And then I had another novel idea, which was about, based on someone I was close to, Joseph Brodsky, about a Russian poet who I mean, it was going to be very fictionalized and not just a portrait of Brodsky, but certainly inspired by him and some experiences that he had and that I shared with him in America. And that, too, I got the 50, 60 pages and I dropped it. And then I discovered this story because it's based on a true story and includes, in fact, a lot of documentary stuff in it, that there was a Polish actress who came to America in the last quarter of the 19th century, giving up her career. She was the queen of the Polish theater, giving up her career in Poland, and came with her husband, her teenage son, and some friends, sort of inspired by Brook Farm, no less, and the idea of going to live on a farm, what we'd call a commune, and living the pure life and getting away from cities and acting and all those decadent modern things. And the farm that they got, the land that they bought, was in Southern California. The year is 1876. And in a village called Anaheim, which is then a village of 2,000 people about, and the only other community in that area was Los Angeles, which had about 10,000 people. Eventually she goes back on stage, et cetera, et cetera, and has this great, even greater triumph in America. That's a true story. The real actress was named Helena Majeska. That was her American stage name. And she played with Edwin Booth, and she was a very famous figure in late 19th century American theater. So I discovered this story just actually browsing in the what to me very lamented Waterstone that existed here in Boston, and I was browsing.
Yeah, we lamented it too. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I accompanied a friend up here to Boston, who a painter who had a gallery opening, a show opening in a gallery here, and I was standing around while he was hanging his show, and I said, "Where's the nearest bookstore?" and wandered off to the Waterstones and picked a book off the shelf, which was a biography of Henryk Sienkiewicz, the famous but now largely forgotten author of Quo Vadis, one of the big bestsellers of all time. And early on in this little biography, it says that he accompanied this great Polish actress and, had been in America for a year. And I thought, oh, goodness, there's my next novel. Because I thought, there's my actress story, and there's my Slavic immigrant coming to America. Of course, I was really scared about putting a novel in the late 19th century, both the two novel ideas that I'd had and discarded were in the 20th century, and I didn't know that I wanted to do another novel like the one before The Volcano Lover that so far in the past. Well, The Volcano Lover was the late 18th century. This would be the late 19th century. I was really scared about getting it right, having to do so much reading. But I plunged in, and why did the story appeal to me? And I didn't know any more than that. I mean, since then, of course, in reading and writing, I discovered a lot more about her, and there are memoirs and letters from the period and reviews. And
letters
stuff
still coming into the Times Book Review, sort of filling in the historical record. But I wondered, what was the Sontag contemporary piece that you wanted to put in this novel?
Well, you can't write a novel about the past that isn't about the present. And I certainly can't write in any way except as a late 20th century American writer. Even if I'm writing about British people in southern Italy in the late 18th century, it's still an American novel written by an American novelist at the end of the 20th century. So I know that even though I want to get the historical record right, and there's even a kind of straight document side to this, a lot of the material is real material of the period, I'm totally transforming it through my sensibility, and it's a way of, well, what's the lure of the story? About transformation, I guess. Self-reinvention. That's what immigrants did when they came here. They were transformed, whether they wanted to or not. These people wanted to be transformed. Most of our ancestors, anyway, mine, were just, coming over in steerage and fleeing, misery and oppression and economic hardship. But there were these voluntary immigrants to the United States in the 19th century who came, well, and now, of course, who came because they wanted the new world.
These are magic words. Hunger to begin with, avidity, but then transformation, self-reinvention. This is Connection Zone. You're in the right place. 1-800-423-8255 is the Connection phone. 1-800-423-8255. Talk with Susan Sontag this hour. Jeremy is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Chris, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Jeremy.
There's so many things that Susan Sontag has written. One thing that I wanted to just bring up, I didn't know if you were going to, is I'm an artist, I'm a painter, I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and she has written so much about art and about painters, and it struck me the depth at which she writes and the avidity she has for different types of artists. A particular artist I'm interested in, that she's interested in, is Howard Hodgkin, and she has written so many beautiful things about his work. And I wonder if she could talk just a little bit about her relationship to painting and painters, and maybe a little bit about Howard Hodgkin's work, why it strikes her. She seems to have a profound understanding of painting that there's a lot of writers that write about painting, but not many write the way she does.
That's high praise from a painter, Jeremy. I don't know Howard Hodgkin, but Susan Sontag, tell us.
Well, I adore Howard Hodgkin's work, and he, in fact, has become a friend. The way we met was I'd known his work and loved his work, and he's one of my favorite living painters, has been for a very long time. But we met because I wrote a story which has since been much anthologized called The Way We Live Now. It was originally published in The New Yorker in the late 80s. And Howard Hodgkin got in touch with me. The story, I think of it as the illness story, but the illness that the main character has is obviously AIDS. And Howard got in touch with me from England, and he said, I'd love this story. Let's do a book together. And it'll be your story, and I will make 6 color lithographs for it. And we'll make it in a limited edition, 100 copies, 200 copies, and it'll sell for $10,000 a copy, and we'll give the money to AIDS charities. And we did. I mean, it was entirely his initiative, and it's a very beautiful book, which actually did come out in a paperback edition published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's called The Way We Live Now, and it has these images, the mass paperback. I mean, mass paperback, it's anyway a paperback we can afford. And so it was a great thrill to know this artist. I mean, it's very kind of you, Jeffrey, to say that I understand painting. I mean, I am doing it very intuitively, but what I will say, just sort of more about everything and not just painting alone, is that I'm really only interested in writing, or I was only interested in writing about things that I admire.
What does one see in a Howard Hodgkin painting?
I think, well, you know, his painting, first of all, I think he's maybe, I wonder if you agree, Jeffrey, the most brilliant colorist, I think, since maybe Matisse. Mm-hmm. He's just a most extraordinary sense of color. It's a color, you know, orgy. But it's subtle, it's voluptuous, it's everything you could want. And he thinks of himself as a representational painter. I think most people would say, no, these are abstractions. They're voluptuous abstractions, but they're the thickness of the paint, the richness of the colors. But he says, no, it's representational, but it represents emotions, not an object, but emotions. You know, what he has in common with, Jasper Johns or Anselm Kiefer, you know, who are two other artists I also admire very much, I can't say. I mean, I don't know what I would be hard put to describe what the things I like or love have in common. I just know that they seem like very full experiences and elevating experiences. I mean, I think there's some very primitive notion about whether you feel dragged down. Well, listen, Chris, am I permitted to quote something you said to me before we went on air?
Sure.
We were talking about the fact that I've just started at you know, I'm in my late 60s to study the piano. I've never studied.
Oh, we're going to come back to that.
Yeah, but let me just say what you said, because it was so beautiful. And you said you had studied piano as a child, but then taking it up in your late 30s, and you said the wonderful thing about playing the piano was you meet such a great class of people.
The better class of people.
Better class of people. Okay, Mozart or whatever.
Well,
I feel I feel that's true, you know, about all the art that one loves, that one is meeting a better class of people and having elevating rather than diminishing experiences.
Should we talk about the piano? I was fascinated that you're embarking on it. a full-grown woman. I was a full-grown guy when I really started semi-seriously, and it's been continuing, I don't always want to say struggle, but discovery, privilege, challenge, joy. Every day I make some noise on that thing.
Are you actually taking lessons?
I will be in a few weeks, but not at the current. I haven't been this winter. But every day, I never leave the house without.
Do you feel doing but I'm interested because I am, you know, just at the beginning. I didn't even.
I've taken a lot of lessons. Yeah.
So you feel that at a certain point you can make progress on your own without a teacher, as long as.
Oh, I didn't say that. No, I break between teachers, or maybe I break them, or I have to struggle on my own, and I shuttle back from jazz to Brahms and Bach and play all of it badly, but with great pleasure and with great discovery. I'm interested in for you because you've done sort of so many other media and forms and ranges, and piano is it's a completely different angle on.
Well, I'll tell you the reason.
Divine or whatever.
Divine is the right word. The reason I wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it for many years until actually a friend said, well, you know, you talk about this, but you don't do it. So, of course, I had to do it. The reason that I gave myself, because, anything else seemed presumptuous, was that I would be able to hear music better. Mm. I go to concerts a lot, and I'm a very self-indulgent buyer of CDs, of recorded music. And I thought, if I knew how to play, I would hear better. Mm. I would hear, just as I think if you love ballet, and you go to, as I do, for instance.
Can I just say, you're listening to The Connection.
I think if you love dance, for instance, and as I do, and I go to a lot of dance performances, and in the great days in New York when Balanchine was alive, I used to go very, very often to the New York City Ballet. If I'd ever gone to a ballet class and studied as a student, even if I was totally inept and incompetent and unable to do anything at any decent level, never mind professional level, but even far below that, just competent level, I would see better because I would understand from the inside. I have known many actors and many directors, film directors, and been on the set of innumerable movies while they were being made. I've made 4 films myself. I know I look at movies better. I watch more intelligently than someone who hasn't had this experience, because I know how they're made, and that doesn't, far from diminishing the pleasure or making me more detached, it actually makes me more observant. So I thought, if I study the piano, I will hear better. That was my original motivation. Of course, a lot of other things have happened since that are added on to that, but that was the reason I wanted to do it.
Well, dancing tells you something about what a dancer is going through, or playing the piano, what a pianist is going through. But then it also leads you up to something that's almost completely unexplainable, which is what Bach was doing in writing it, or Brahms, or Beethoven, particularly Bach and Brahms for me. Do you start with, as a lot of people do, with those Bach 2-part inventions?
Oh, I'm starting much earlier, because remember, you'd studied as a child. No, it is Bach, but it's not even 2-part inventions. It's little toy Bach.
Well, even that, I mean, it's Mozart, Twinkle, Twinkle. There's just a mystery about the architecture, the engineering, the thinking, the sourcing, the creation of that stuff. That I don't know. Does anything compare with it?
Yeah, but that. But would you say the architecture and the thinking and the creation? That's what I meant about hearing.
Hmm.
I didn't, when I say I would hear better, I don't mean that I would say know why Mitsuko Uchida is a better pianist than Alfred Brendel. You know, it's not like I would be a better evaluator of pianists. It's that I would hear music better because I would know how it was made. And I wanted to have that technical knowledge of how the music was made, not the piano was played, but the music was made. And I thought, I'll only know that if I actually can play an instrument. The piano, listen, the truth is, Chris, I don't have a piano. I have a Yamaha keyboard mounted on a frame. It's got a little electronic chip, and if I press another button, it sounds like a harpsichord or an organ. I don't deserve a piano yet. A couple of years from now, I'll get a piano.
Well, I got a piano before I deserved it. I still don't deserve it, but it's an important thing. It's also important, unlike writing, I think, to know that it's a physical experience. Making music is a sort of in the body sort of process. It is halfway to a sport.
Did you find? I mean, you started in your late 30s, and I'm 67, so that's a different time.
And I'm not in my late
30s
anymore either.
Yeah, but you also did it as a child, so you already knew the basic things.
I knew where middle C was.
I find it's very interesting. Have never played an instrument, and not even knowing I had to actually learn how to, you know, what the notes were. I mean, not only where the middle C is on the keyboard, but what it looks like on a stave. I find that I have certain advantages, I think, or I intuit, over a child learning. For instance, I'm never bored.
We'll come back to this. I mean, we may learn a lot of things better as grown-ups. It's an important question. Susan Sontag is our guest, the woman who read and did everything and still does it. New things, too. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Susan Sontag is our guest, the novelist, most recently of In America, but across the board, one of the reigning intellectuals of our time, the very idea of an intellectual for all sorts of people. 1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation, or 1-800-423-TALK. Lindsay is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Lindsay. Welcome.
Thank you. I had a quick question, which is, I guess, somewhat impertinent and personal, but since you put it in play, Chris, I'll ask. I wondered about your child, the son that you had early on, and very intellectual life, and it sounded like an amazing household. What was the eventual life like? Are you still in touch? Is there repercussions from positive and negative from where you think your early life was on your development there?
Well, my son is the love of my life. I talk to him every day. We live a couple of blocks away from each other. We are very, very close friends. I see him all the time. He is a very distinguished writer. His name is David Reif, R-I-E-F-F. He's working on his sixth book, which is he writes on public affairs and politics. He's written two books on Cuban community in Miami, a book on the war in Bosnia, a book on immigrant communities in Los Angeles. Is now working on a very ambitious book on humanitarian aid projects, and he's covered the genocide in Rwanda.
We've talked to them about the Balkans. What does he think about Ilian Gonzalez?
Well, he had a wonderful op-ed piece, which has gotten a lot of attention in the New York Times just on Sunday. He thinks he should be returned to his father, of course. And as do I.
But from Hegel in his diapers to today, I mean.
Well, David has a mind of his own. He's a separate human being, but he's a very grand and noble person who does absolutely, you know, honorable, noble work covering human disasters. He's a great critic of the United Nations. He's a very, very serious cultural commentator and political journalist, and very independent. He's attached to no, you know, magazine or newspaper. He writes for a lot of different papers, Atlantic Monthly and New Republic and New Yorker and New York Times and so on. But I have to say, I think the imputation of the question, tell me, Lindsay, if I'm wrong, is that surely there must have been a tremendous reaction. And, you know, obviously he would, you know, become a baseball player or, you know, have a lot of metal in his face or do something else. Well, not at all. I mean, I believe in what I do and he believes in what he does. And we're the best of friends, and I greatly admire him.
I'm afraid it was nothing so complicated as that. It was really just curiosity.
Well, he's a wonderful writer, and I'm happy to give him a plug. I think he's been on your show, right?
Yes, he has indeed. Yeah. I thought Lindsay was wondering if you had a book on mothering in you.
Well, it's certainly the most important experience in my life. What can I say? And I had.
That's a very interesting statement for a famously bookish woman.
Well, that's the cliche. If I may be so presumptuous.
Which, that you're famously bookish or that,
no, that, you
or
think
that mothering that, is the great experience?
No, neither. That you think it's a very interesting thing to say, as if one excludes the other. I'm many things, and just because I like to read books doesn't mean that I don't have every ordinary emotion and passion as well. I think it's a little problem that people think that if you're smart or bookish, especially if you're a woman, when that's supposed to be something weird or worthy of remarking on, that you wouldn't have all the ordinary human and specifically womanly feelings. There's no contradiction whatsoever. Not even anything interesting. It's just, you know, one is many different things.
Okay. My mother was that way. She was a powerful mind and who found herself in having six children. And yet it's just interesting. We were talking about this the other day with the writer Claudia Roth Pierpont in a marvelous book, I think, about called Passionate Minds, about sort of pre-movement women, all kinds of women, from Gertrude Stein to Margaret Mitchell to Mary McCarthy to Hannah Arendt to Olive Schreiner, the sort of the mothers of the Susan Sontag generation in a way, but they didn't have children, and a lot of them thought very aggressively that they didn't want children or couldn't cope with children. Doris Lessing left her children. I mean, it didn't come automatically to the synthesis that you happily embrace.
You know? Well, I guess, again, maybe I'm just being too primitive in my answer, but I never thought of it as a problem. I, to tell you the truth, the only regret of my life, and I have no regrets because you can't, you know, like Edith Piaf said, well, I don't regret anything because, anyway, what good would it do? The only regret of my life is that I only had one child. I think God, to have missed that experience would be just like some kind of the bumpsman, like not having arms and legs or something.
How many would you like?
Oh, three at least. At least three.
That's a good number. I think really and truly, without being too intrusive, I think people want to know those things about, for a woman who's encompassed so much experience directly and in books, what do you count as the overwhelming pleasures of life?
I have, being alive is to me something I'm constantly grateful for. I'm the most important thing in life is one's own humanity and one's solidarity with other people and personal relations and feeling ecstasy. I think we're all in search of Keith Jarrett said, we were talking about music before, and he said a very beautiful thing, that what people are looking for in music and why music draws us is it's our most reliable, maybe I'm paraphrasing here, maybe I said it, I don't know, but he said something like this, it's our most reliable access to ecstasy. So, you know, there's so many things that can produce ecstasy. But I think, you know, a child and bringing up a child, there is, I mean, that's maybe the supreme experience of one's life.
Keith Jarrett is a wise man. I it reminds me of something I wanted to quote to you earlier. The late wonderful composer Earl Kim said to me years ago.
I don't know him.
Well, he died about a year and a half ago. A wonderful man, taught at Princeton and Harvard and wrote exquisite minimalist music, and not an awful lot of it, but a very thoughtful man, the best ears I ever listened to music with. But anyway, he said he'd been a prodigious sight reader as a child in an enviable way. He said they couldn't print it fast enough for me to read it. And he could read symphonies like Liszt, you know, he could read the whole, show him a symphony page, and he could play it on the piano. But anyway, he said to me once, said, you know, the world could be a happy place, a really happy place, if everybody, and I mean everybody, would go home and practice the piano. As a kind of balm, therapy, test, exercise, history lesson, physical exercise. It is a kind of, and ecstasy. The miracle is that anybody can play the piano as badly as you and I do and still feel the ecstasy.
Well, I agree with you, except that what also occurs to me is that most people on this planet do not have a room of their own. Most people can't go home and play the piano because not only do they not have a piano, they share their living space, their actual sleeping and living space, with a number of other human beings. We live, Chris, you and I, and I wager every single person listening to this program, unbelievably privileged lives compared to the majority of people on this planet. And I don't forget that ever. Every single day of my life, I think about how awful, materially deprived and difficult most people's lives are. So yes, the world would be, our part of the world would be happier, but then what happens to the 80%, the rest of humanity, how they're living? They can't go home and play the piano because they're a bunch of screaming babies and elderly people in the same room which they live in.
Well, we're going to make more pianos anyway. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Susan Sontag. Robert is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Robert. Good.
I just wanted to say hello to an old friend, Susan. This is Robert Paul Wolf.
Oh, Robert. And oh, my God. We read Kant together.
45 years ago, when your David was a little baby, and I met him when I walked you home from class one day.
Where are you?
I'm in Massachusetts, teaching at the University of Massachusetts. I'm in Afro-American Studies now, after a lifetime in philosophy.
You're in Amherst?
Yep.
At UMass?
UMass Amherst.
I'm gonna call you tomorrow.
Wonderful. Listen, I just wanted to say, I mean, obviously, I have many things to say about your magnificent career, but first I just wanted to say I've gone back to the viola after a lifetime away, and listening to the two of you talk about the piano, I know exactly how you feel about, I play quartets every week very badly, but there's something about actually sitting with three other musicians and playing a Mozart quartet, even though nobody else in the world beside the four of us would want to hear the noises we were making, that is absolutely exalting and unusual. You know, it's a totally separate experience from sitting in a concert hall and listening to other people play. But, Chris, I also just wanted to say hello to you because we've had satyrs together at Bernie Abishai's.
Aha! Uh-huh. Robert Wolf, indeed.
Yes. All right. I didn't have a whole lot. I'd much rather hear Susan talk.
No, but listen, Robert, I'm so happy that you called. And let's be in touch. This is great. This is absolutely magic. This magic. This is Chris's magic. And I will be in touch.
There's a viola piano duet in here somewhere. Robert, thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Susan Sontag. Old friends and new, call her up. 1-800-423-TALK. Bert is on the line. Hello, Bert.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chris, a few minutes ago, you were very graciously, I think, surprised at Susan's feeling for her son. Let me say this. I grew up with Susan in Tucson, Arizona, many years ago. Our families were friends. And she was the All-American girl. I mean, I think Susan is being very modest with her background. My remembrance of Susan, and I have some old pictures of her on horses with her at Max Siegel's ranch.
Oh, my God. This is
old home week. Okay.
This is unbelievable.
On Oracle Road with her sister Judy, and then we all took a trip over to California once. And, she was a wonderful person, and down through the years, we've certainly lost track, but I've always had the greatest feeling when I see her on television or read her books, and it's just marvelous because she's such a genuine person, and somehow, and again, Chris, you seemed to crack through that a little earlier about her feeling for her son. I'm not at all surprised. She was the All-American girl.
Well, listen, will you get in touch with me? I'm going to burst into tears.
I'd love to, Susan.
Can you write me care of my publisher, Farrah Straus and Giroux, and give me your address? We can't do this on the radio with hundreds of thousands of people listening.
Certainly.
But
what is your publisher? It didn't come.
Farrah Straus and Giroux, 19 Union Square West, New York, New York 10003. Okay. Please write me and send me your address, and we're going to meet.
I'd love it.
Okay, bye.
Bert, thank you. Susan Sontag, this is your life. It's really fascinating, and this is not the first time it's happened.
This is your show, Chris. This is magic. I made friends because of someone who called in the last time I was on your show. So I'm incredibly moved.
Well, you know, it's very, very interesting to me, sort of who you went to high school and who went to high school with you. I discovered once upon a time that Milton Babbitt, the composer, went to high school in Jackson, Mississippi, with Eudora Welty.
Really?
And I thought, now, isn't that interesting? Who would have guessed, listening to his music, that it came out of the same classroom, in a way, as her stories? But who knows what Bert has done, or Robert Wolf, for that matter, out of the same fabric, in a way, as Susan Sontag.
But, you know, I think that there is some kind of inner call that people have. I remember Jasper Johns, who grew up in a village in South Carolina, and very very remote from anything to do with art, his family background, in a very very small town in South Carolina. And I said, when did you decide you wanted to be a painter? And he said, when I was six. And I said, what? How could you have known that? And he said, I don't know. Maybe I saw a picture of a sunset in Woolworths or something. I mean, you know, it's like you have it. Somehow you could almost believe in some sort of platonic pre-existence, that you have it in you and you're going to seize on whatever it is that encourages you to follow that vocation.
But Bert is telling me, I mean, he's reprimanding me a little bit, sort of saying, don't you realize she always will be the all-American girl. Is that, I don't know, do you like to be remembered that way, seen that way, as opposed to the prodigious mind with the white streak in her dark hair?
Well, sure. Why? Yes, I don't... Sure. you're leaving me speechless. Well, here I am talking and, you know, and going around and hoping that people will like my new novel and all the rest of it. But I don't really see myself. So I think anything... I don't know. I don't see myself from the outside. So if somebody says I was the all-American girl, did I ride horses and do all those things when I was a kid? Of course I did. Of course I'm an American, for heaven's sakes. You know, yeah. My son had a different background because why? I was living here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, we're not in Cambridge, but anyway, I was living in the Boston, Greater Boston. When my son was, you know, walking into the breakfast nook and saying, Hegel, 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 it was Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was a graduate student at Harvard and reading, you know, Kant with Robert Paul Wolf. So, sure, you know, it wasn't Pokemon cards. It was he was just repeating something he heard. But it didn't, you know, he had to have it in him to go on. We find ourselves, whatever it is, but... We start and are rooted in our basic humanity.
You recommend, in a fashion, you recommend the kind of childhood you gave your son, though, right?
It was natural to me. I wouldn't betray what I cared about. I wouldn't say, okay, you go out and watch television and play ball and don't worry about all those books. No, I shared with him what I loved. I remember I took him to the Fogg Museum when he was about 4 years old, and we walked through it, and we came out, and he said, he might even have been three, and he said, tell me, what are all those pictures of the mommy and the baby?
You're listening to The Connection.
He said, tell me, what are all those pictures of the mommy and the baby? And I thought, oh, okay, now I get to tell the story of Christ and Mary and... There's, you know, there's all that. And another time we went for a walk and he saw a picture of George Washington. This week he was about two and a half. And he said, who's that? And I said, oh, I thought, my God, where to start? that's the first president of the United States. And I realized he didn't know what a president was. He didn't know what the United States was, and so on. So, you know, I got all finished with my little explanation. He said, can we go meet him? And then I realized, no, now I had to explain to him what death was, you know. So this is what childhood is about. It's not, you know, it's about the deepest things and about, and that's this connection of explaining everything and understanding a thing and being sincere and being real.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, the Susan Sontag connection. Can I just anticipate listeners and say, I think what people always want to know, I want to know from somebody like you, is not exactly what you're reading this minute, but for people who aren't going to read a fragment of what you read, share the best stuff. Give us three books that we don't want to miss.
Okay. The Brothers Karamazov.
Amen. You read my mind. Okay.
Well, I feel very much I'm a sort of child of, in my head, of Russian literature, that I wouldn't be the person I am if I hadn't read Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov. They really... These are deepening experiences. These are wonderful experiences. There's so many great books. I don't even know where to begin. Let me put it this way. Ideally, don't read a book that you wouldn't want to reread or that wouldn't be worth rereading.
Well, read it now so that you can read it the fifth time in 10 years.
Well, you should read things that matter, that are going to nourish you. I mean, it's read things that are deepening. There are a lot of those books out there, and they're all the famous ones. All the, you know, I mean, one has a different sort of itinerary or journey. For instance, The Magic Mountain was a great book of my early adolescence and sort of introduced me to the idea of Europe and all these great themes of European civilization. But, you know, it could be some other book that would be your introduction, how you would move in, and then you create your own itinerary.
What do you reread for just reassurance? The way I don't know, you didn't ask, but I just reread The Golden Bull with just sort of infinite pleasure.
Isn't he amazing, James? He is. I do reread James. The Portrait of a Lady, yep. I think, is just staggering, a staggering book. And even books that, you know, that aren't so famous, like Washington Square, which is generally, you know, you say, oh, yeah, that was a movie, that was a play or something like that. You think of it as kind of minor. It's perfection. It's not very long. It's not at all difficult. Or The Bostonians is an absolutely amazing book. It has kind of odious moral attached to it. But the brilliance of the writing and the thinking and the feeling and the dramatization. James is really, really wonderful. And The Golden Bowl is, yeah. Sometimes I think it's the greatest novel ever written. It's certainly one of the oddest.
Wings of the Dove and The Ambassadors would credit some. But you make, I mean, inevitably you say read the great ones, and that's why they're great. That's why they're cliches of being great. But then again, what are the great ones we don't know? What are the Sontag exclusives?
Oh, I don't know. There are lots of wonderful books that have been written in the last 20, 30 years. I'm a great admirer of an Austrian writer, Thomas Bernhardt. These are very, very eccentric books. They're kind of single-voiced, angry books. He's a little bit like Beckett in the sense that it's one voice always, and everything is filtered through that voice. But I think he's a great writer. There's a Hungarian writer named Peter Nadas, N-A-D-A-S, one very long book called A Book of Memories and a short one called The End of the Family Story. I think he's a marvelous writer. Well, there's so many great writers.
There's your reading list, Connection listeners, starting with Brothers Karamazov and then discovering Peter Nadas. Susan Sontag, it's a terrific pleasure to have you on The Connection. Connection listeners, if you're anywhere near Boston tonight, Wednesday, April 5th, Susan Sontag will be at the Coolidge Corner Theater at 6 o'clock in Brookline. Thanks for help today from Glenn Alexander, John Hoder, Allison Bagg, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Our website is theconnectiononeword.org. Our website producer is Jim Norse. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hatti, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior producer and reigning intellectual. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to all the news, special reports on the volatile stock market, census by snowmobile in rural Maine, and Kathy